I hear the train a-coming, it's rolling around a bend, and I ain't seen the sunshine since I don't know when. I'm stuck in Folsom Prison, and time keeps dragging on. But that train keeps a-rolling on down to San Antone. When I was just a baby, my mama told me, son, always be a good boy, don't ever play with guns. But I shot a man in Reno just to watch him die. When I hear that whistle blowing, I hang my head and cry.
So you like Johnny Cash, right?
Yeah.
You down with the Man in Black?
I'm down, man. I'm down.
That's my homage to rock country.
To rock country.
So that's as country as I get.
That's just,
yeah, like, so someone was starting talking about Waylon Jennings. I'm like, who the hell is Waylon Jennings? But I think, wasn't he like in the movie? Like, what was that movie called? Like
Walk the Line
or something? Wasn't Waylon Jennings in there or something like that?
I don't know. But it's funny because as you well know and harass me about for most of my youth. My mom's a big country music fan.
She is.
So when I was a kid, I was like, well, I guess you always harass me about my dad listening to like the old stuff, the 50s stuff.
The doo-wop stuff.
But in my mom's car, it was always country music.
Yeah.
Because it reminded her of Hawaiian
music. So you had a lot of Randy Travis in there or what? With his paper suit?
No paper suit. No, Words with Friend Wednesdays or anything. But it was...
after he's in the slam of his paper suit. Hey, it's Words with Friend Wednesday.
Yeah.
why don't you say, what are you going to play? Drunk Off My Ass.
And so yeah, she would always listen to that, right? So if I was in her car, I was always listening to country, which I couldn't really stand, right? But then kind of like... Now with the job I have... At the Green Egg place, like, he's always playing country, so it's kind of like bring me back to the youth and actually kind of enjoy some of the songs, dude. It's nowhere near as bad as I thought.
So
and when I was depressed in the summer, it was really good.
Talking about like your dog died,
yeah, and your dog got shot, and your girlfriend's banging your best friend and everything.
The dog's banging your best friend.
Yeah, that too.
Hey man, hey, I don't want anything to do with that, right? You keep your dog away from me, dude. Before we get into this whole Shamrock and Shenanigans, and we got to open with the Shamrock and Shenanigans too, and seeing how you've had a nice little conversation with Dan the Automator, who did Deltron 3030, one of the best theme albums of all time. We'll have to get some Sir Mix-a-Lot in there too. But before I kind of start this whole thing, I want to tell you about my day, if you will. So you got to realize that I never spent a lot of money on shoes. You know, like, I always bought like the cheap stuff and everything. Like, I remember when I was like 6 or 7 years old, I bought like a pair of off the wall Vans, the kind that didn't have any shoelaces on them, and they had the checkers on the side. And when I bought those, like, all my friends geeked out. Like, man, like, where'd you get those shoes? Like, nobody had that pair, right? It was like $35. Now, I spent my own money on these pair of shoes, $35. And my stepdad still came down on me. They're like, why are you spending $35 on your shoes? I'm like, because I want these flipping shoes because they're flipping tight, right? So I never really bought a lot of pair of shoes. And they're, in my course of, like, Hall of Fame, like, shoes that I bought, there's some pretty bad shoes. I think from third grade to fifth grade, I bought these gray, like, they're called coasters. You bought them at Payless Shoes. And there's, like, these ugly-ass shoes, but they're, like, $15, so I bought them, and I could pull them off. I can pull off any shoe.
You never rocked the Peaks?
I did rock
them. From Payless?
Yeah, I did rock those, yeah.
And back in the day when Mervyn's had the Cheetahs?
Never had the Cheetahs.
You remember those, though, right?
I remember the Cheetahs. I remember the Roos, too, with the little pocket in there. Yeah. And kids love the Roos.
Actually, I mentioned that in my class a couple weeks ago.
With the pocket?
And they're coming back.
Yeah. Well, this is even funnier. So my... I bought my first pair of Jordans last year. I think it was like $75, right? And I was like, and I told you, I was like, man, these are like my first pair of Jordans I ever had. And they were decent. You know, it's like a good introductory shoe. You buy your first pair of Jordans and stuff. So I was rocking it. So I, when, you know, being a father now, it's like whenever you go to school, it's like, I have a 6-year-old, I have a 9-year-old, and like every flipping day, it's like, oh, can I have a play date? Can I have a play date? Can I have a play date? It's like, god damn, dude. It's like, what's up with all these play dates, you know? So finally, like, my youngest daughter had a play date. And so I had some time with my oldest daughter, and we went out to lunch to a place she wanted to go to and stuff. Really fun. And I was like, hey, I'm like, I need some shoes, because my shoes reek, you know? I mean, like, they smell, like, you could smell me walking down, and that's how bad these shoes were. They just smelled that bad. And even, like, the Febreze and stuff wasn't working anymore, right? And it was just really bad. It was just, like, really dirty, just terrible looking. So I went to a Foot Locker. I looked at the shoes. There were some Jordans that I saw, like, $105. And I'm kind of under the assumption now, it's like, there's an old saying, like, life is too short for cheap wine. Well, I think life is too short for cheap shoes, you know? If, like, you want to... And my man over here, this is Bet I Have My Donuts over here on Bad News Rum. He used to work. And he used to sell shoes. And this guy would come, like, every other week, just come with these, like, new kicks. I'm like, dude, I'm like, where the hell did you get those, man? Like, hook me up, you know? And, like, right now, he's rocking some tight-ass shoes right now, dude. Just, like, you know, simple, but, I mean, they're on point. So this guy's always killed me in shoes every single time. So
you got to get that shoe game up to par.
Yeah, now you got to step your shoe game up. Step your game up. You got to step your shoe game up, right? So I was looking at some Jordans. I'm like, okay. And then guess what I saw? Like, standing right there, like, right in front of me, dude. You telling me to stop?
Let me guess.
Yeah.
Tigers.
They weren't the Tigers, dude. No.
You know they got Tigers back again.
El Tigre?
No. Do you remember? Go ahead, finish your story.
Okay, so the shoes right in front of me, dude.
Where at, though?
Right in front of me. Gary Payton, the gloves are coming back.
Gloves?
And here's the thing. So they had the black gloves, right? So I look at the price. And it's like $140. I was like, damn, I remember when I bought these for like $95. And that was like the most I ever spent for shoes was the gloves. Now, I had the white gloves. And those white gloves were tight, dude, like leather. And it, like the inside shoe was weak. It was like a weak-ass shoe, but that flipping leather glove just like made it. They're like, I mean, everybody used to look at those shoes. They're like, man, like, what are those space boots? I'm like, I don't care what they are. They're flipping tight, right? I'm like, you can't say they're bad, right? Like, no, man, those shoes are nice. So, of course, me being me, I had to go to Shoe Palace and check out Shoe Palace. And Shoe Palace was just weak. So during that time that I'm going from Foot Locker to Shoe Palace, like, I have some cash on me. And I'm like, well, I can use the cash and then, you know, I can put the rest on card. So it's really not going to be like a – so for some reason, the Paytons to me were like kind of like – for some reason, they're like $110. So I'm like, well, I can drop down $25 and then, you know, and then I can just pay for the Paytons, right? So I go back and I look at the Gary Paytons. She's like, fuck, those are $140. I'm like, ah, man. I'm like, yeah, but those are Paytons. And I'm like, hey, I'm like, tell me you got the white ones. And the girl was like, oh, those get released like in 2 weeks. I was like, man, I already have those shoes, dude. I already rocked those shoes way back when, dude.
When she said that to you, did you look at her and say, 2 weeks?
No. I looked at her. I did the gorilla monsoon. I said, please.
will you stop?
So it's like, so I'm like, ah, whatever, dude. So I'm starting to look at all these other shoes. And like, so there's these Jordans. They're kind of throwbacks. They're like $105. And so I'm like, okay, I can probably get with these, right? And my daughter's with me. She's like, oh, those would be pretty good. So I have, like, my 9-year-old daughter telling me what's tight or not, right? So I put them on. You know, when you put some shoes on, like, they look good, right? But then you put them on, and you're not feeling them, right? So, like, it's like buying a shoe is like a fine wine, you know? It's like, if you don't feel it, you don't feel it, right?
Okay.
So I'm looking around, and so then I'm looking at some other shoes, and they have all these LeBrons and stuff. I was like, ah, LeBrons are okay, but I can't sport no LeBrons, dude. You know, it's like... If I'm going to support anything, I'm going to support the Jordans or Nike Airs, right? So I see some of the shoes, and they have these Chris Pauls. They're pretty nice, you know, about $100. And I was like, okay, they're nice. But then there's these crazy-ass shoes over in the corner, right? Like crazy-ass Nike Airs, $129, right? So straight blue, has the white base on them. The Airs are pink. Like, you know, you can see the Air, they're pink, right? And it has like a pink stripe going all the way up the middle. And the tongue is pink. And I was like... I just kept on getting drawn back to them. I'm like, man, those are some crazy-ass shoes. You know, like, only I can, like, rock those, right? And so I got the salesman. He's a good salesman, right? And I was like, well, let me try the Chris Pauls, and let me try these crazy-ass shoes here. He's like, man, he's all, those ain't crazy. I got a pair at home. I'm like, are they good? He's like, yeah, man. I'm like, and the sag level on your jeans, it's not going to, like, cuff on your jeans, right? And he's like, I don't think so. I'm like, hey, I'm gonna do no prison level, right? And it's like, I just want to know if, you know, because I sag a little bit, if it's going to cuff up. He's like, nah, it's not. So, I put the Chris Pauls on. They work. But I'm looking at these shoes. I'm like, fuck it. I'm like, I'm just going to buy these shoes. They're crazy. You know, like, nobody else will flip and buy them. I'm just feeling them, right? Like, because when you see a pair of shoes, you got to feel them, dude.
Plus, you can accessorize with the Pussy Wagon keychain.
Yeah, so I'm saying. I got to find that Pussy Wagon keychain. I still want to put my car. I want to put the upholstery in my car, like the Pussy Wagon, in Kill Bill. That's like my dream.
That's the dream.
So
I thought it was the GTO with the flames on the side.
No, that's Carlito's way.
I know.
Yeah. No. So
that was your dream.
Now, my dream is to get the Pussy Wagon interior inside, and put the Pussy Wagon on the back, you know, with the little, like, get the little paint and stuff. If I ever get into money, that's what I'm going to do. And then I'll buy a GTO on top of that. So it's just kind of the way that I feel, right?
Okay.
So here we are at the Foot Locker for the second time in a row. So who comes walking in, right? You ready who comes walking in? You already know because I told you.
That's where you saw?
Yeah, so Vernon Davis comes walking in. And so, you know, like, people, like, it's funny because, like, you know, you have a lot of quote-unquote Niner fans here, right? So I see Vernon Davis right off the bat, and I ain't a fanboy, dude. Like I used to be like, you know,
you didn't even mark.
No, I didn't mark. So you know how like Cole says he's a journalist, or Bobby the Brain Heenan way back when said he was a journalist,
broadcast journalist.
Yeah, these guys ain't. I was a journalist, dude. So like, I don't.
Cole was a war correspondent. Continue.
Well, whatever, dude. A war zone correspondent. So yeah, I don't do the typical things like. And this is like the second time I've talked to him before. Like he was walking like. He had like this badass car like in this place called Santana Row in San Jose, which is all like that's where all high society in San Jose is. That's where they go, right? So I see this one dude in like this like bitch ass like really expensive car. I'm like, man, who's this bitch trying to style and profile with this like weak? You know, it's a nice car, but it's like you can just tell it's all about the money, right? And I look at him like, oh shit, that's Vernon Davis. So like I'm crossing the street, and he's kind of crossing the street too. And we're kind of a little bit far away, and I'm like, hey, Vernon. And he kind of looks around, I'm like, hey, Vernon. And so he finally says, hey, man, like, good luck on Sunday, right? And that's it. I just keep on going. So, oh, hey, thanks, man. And so, like, there's a guy, like, walking away. He's like, who is that? I'm like, it's Vernon Davis, dude. And so that guy, like, starts running over to him or something, right? So, of course, you know, you have the Saints and 49ers game. You know, you have that badass play where Ahmad Brooks, like, total legal hit, strips the ball, lands in the guy's lap. Game over, right?
So little clothesline?
Yeah, I mean, it was a legit play, but they called a foul on it, so I was like, hey, Vernon, I'm like, hey, man, I'm like, what's up with that play? And he kind of looks around. I'm like, hey, man, what's up with that play against the Saints, man? He's like, oh, man, they're always trying to steal the game away from us and stuff. So the guy's really down to earth. It was really cool. So, I got a cool pair of shoes. I got to talk to Vernon Davis for the second time, so I thought it was pretty cool. So I just wanted to start off with that, you know, whether you enjoyed it or not. I don't care because I got some crazy ass shoes that I can sport. I got the pink tongues going on, and I'm just rocking it right now, dude. So I'm very happy today.
That's good. That's good, Doc.
That's real good, Doc.
Well, my little thing was you don't remember? So before Asics became Asics, they were Tigers.
Back to
Do
basics.
You remember that?
Yeah, back to basics. Kick Shin Asics, right?
Right.
Lord Jamar, right?
Yep. So they actually came back with like. Some Japanese company got the rights to the Tiger name again, and so they're making them. It's kind of like that stylized Japanese style, but it still has the ASICs logo on the side. They're pretty sick looking. So I might have to cop some of those if I ever find them. I don't want to, you know.
You still got the hookup and shoes or what?
Nah, I don't know.
All I know, man, your shoes were. You had the Sanders going on, dude. You had some sick ass cross trainers that I've never seen before in my life.
Well, my favorite haul was the original Air Max Chris Webbers.
Yeah.
It was the first shoe that had the Air Max from the heel all the way to the sole. It had the white ones.
You know what they're selling for now?
I know they went, when they came out, they went for $120. I got them for $60.
Yeah.
I just got to throw that in there. But I would imagine they got to be close to $2 at this
they're
point.
About, yeah, 182 bills. And those are nice. I saw those. Yeah, those are nice. I look at that tongue and I was like, man, I think they're like $240.
Yeah, that original pair I got lasted me well over 10 years. And I did shed a tear when the soul finally went out on me, because I wore the hell out of those things.
The worst thing is when the air pops, dude.
And the air never popped on.
See, that's why
the soul detached from from like the rest of the shoe.
And the crazy glue couldn't fix it, right?
Couldn't make it happen.
See, the worst thing that happened with me was with my Peytons, because they would have lined, right? And so the line would have the air in it. Well, a thorn got stuck in that line and popped the line. So it popped like one air pocket. He was like, I got to get rid of these now, dude.
You know, there's another one that they brought back like a couple years ago that I kind of liked, even though it was kind of an ugly shoe, but I just liked it because of who it was, and I liked the commercials. The Tim Hardaway's with the Velcro X-Cross.
I got skills. Yeah. The most underrated shoe of all time has to be the Scottie Pippen's, dude. Those Scottie Pippins were nice,
with the air on the
side. Yeah, those were the most underrated shoes ever, dude.
Those were sick.
And those cross trainers that you got I was like, dude, give me some of those cross trainers. You're like, they discontinued them or something like that.
Well, as bad as it was too, when I was like early on, it was before I was working when I was in middle school, I got the, as much as I hate the Raiders, dude, I got those Bo Jacksons. Dude.
I remember.
Those Bo Jacksons.
Bo Jacksons were tight, dude.
I had two. I had the one that was the white with the neon green, because that was flying today. Flying. And then I came back with the silver and blacks.
We're wearing your Hawaiian muscle shirts, right?
Yep. And my jams.
Your jams? Your Iron Man shirt? not the Tony Stark's Iron Man shirt, but the Hawaiian Iron Man shirt. That was a tight shirt.
Yeah.
And I would rock the Locomotion with the peach Locomotion shirt and stuff.
And I have my TNC surf with Tiki Man and Thriller Gorilla.
And you can't forget Joe Cool, man. Where's Joe Cool, dude? That was my boy right there.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, so
that was a good little memory lane for 15 minutes.
Where's Nas at when I need him?
He's in the park.
Sipping ginger out of a plastic cup, or is that Mobb Deep?
That's
Mobb Deep, yeah. Yes. One of the best lines ever.
But Nas was chilling in the park.
One of the best, and most of these listeners right here, when we say like Nas's first album, probably what, top five, you think? Top five rap albums of all time? Just straight. I would have to say. I mean, it's not a glorified album. It's like there's not a lot of hits to it.
It wasn't the whole time.
But I think it is now too.
Well, no, people don't know about Nas anymore because Nas didn't have the longevity of some of these
Jay-Z
other guys.
Even
though when they went one on one, Nas verbally destroyed Jay-Z,
which is pretty much unheard of because everybody loves Jay-Z so much. But all the people that are like down and like listen to a ton of rap, starting from like Grandmaster Flash, they're all saying Nas took that.
When you hear, you listen to Ether, man, he destroyed Jay-Z on that. But I shall digress. Speaking of music, man,
and
it was rock country.
There we go.
Nah, I don't know. I just what would you want to start off with on rock country? You want to talk about? Speaking of music,
okay.
And I will tie it in with your boy.
Oh man!
Did they absolutely kill you? Is it worth him getting the Intercontinental Championship for them to take all the baseline out of Big E's song?
I don't know, dude. I would much rather have Big E come out with his theme music than be an Intercontinental Champion, just because of the history of the Intercontinental Championship over the past like 2-3 years, where now he's going to job to everybody and he's not going to win his title. You know, he's not going to win his non-title matches. Yeah, just
I kind of actually think this guy might
be
the guy.
It around.
Well, I think he might be the guy. Like everybody else that got the belt, you could kind of see like that there was really no direction that character was headed. Like as many times as they gave it to The Miz or Kofi Kingston or like Axel, like
Cody Rhodes.
Cody had a good run. Cody had the best run out of the last 3 years.
The last good run.
But he had the last good run on the IC belt. And like I had high hopes for Axel early, like when he won it. But you could see the way that they started doing the matches, like it was going nowhere. But they booked Big E so strong recently, and I think that they are trying to push to have like this kind of like monster baby face that they don't really have. I think he is actually going to have a strong run with that belt. So
the problem I have with the whole remix of it is it takes away. You know, we always talk about the little things. It takes away from the little things, like his entrance. This side of probably CM Punk and The Shield and the Wyatt family. I think he had the best entrance. And you can put, like, his entrance was comparable to Dolph Ziggler. You know, like, just a really good entrance. But you take away that bass line, you take away that song, it just... And you do, like, this techno battle crap to it. I mean, it's like a early 1990s remix of a rap song. You know, just really bad.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting there going, like... When I heard it, it's like, okay, he's going to win the title because they repackaged him and stuff and everything. But I don't know, dude. Yeah. I don't like it.
I just think the original song that he had, like, it fit his character, right? Like, you know, this heavy, heavy bass. This guy's coming in, like, you know, he not to go all JYD, but he's got the thump every time he hits a move. It has a heavy impact. And I thought, like, character-wise, I thought that song fit him perfectly.
Yeah.
Whereas this is like it's all light with it's a bunch of treble, right?
Yeah.
He's not a treble kind of guy in my eyes.
As smart as this guy is, he has to realize that that doesn't work.
Well, I doubt it was his decision.
It wasn't. Yeah, but all I'm saying is like, if he has any pull at all, it's like go back to your old song because even his entrance when he has the white powder and stuff. I mean, that white powder doesn't work with his new entrance music, and then. When he gets up on the ring and just starts pounding his chest and you have like this happy-go-lucky music in the background, it's like, it doesn't work, dude. It's as bad as Miz's haircut. And so before we get it, because I want to get into the Miz too, and I'm trying to figure out, like, how come I don't like this guy as much anymore, and there's a couple things. But the Intercontinental match, it wasn't a good match. Axel has had better matches, and there really it was kind of like anticlimactic because there wasn't any spots to it. So it's like, as much as we like Big E and we think he's going to have a big future, as much as we respect Curtis Axel, I think the difference is from what Curtis Axel can be or what people think or what we think he should be. It didn't get the job done. It wasn't a big buildup, even leading up to the match. Mm-hmm. And it kind of makes me wonder whether Big E was going to win that at the pay-per-view if Axel didn't get hurt. But the match itself wasn't that good. I mean, it was kind of more like a squash match. You know, like he hits him with the clothesline, and then he puts him in the. There's one spot where in the beginning of the match where Big E has him up. You know, he has him up where he could have put on the big ending, and he like does a backdrop or something like that. It's like, dude, I'm like, that doesn't make any sense. First of all, there, so that kind of stops the match for me. And then, you know, Axel kind of grinds away and stuff, and then Big E comes back, and he comes back for like 20 seconds, and he finishes him off. So. It could have been better. It could have been a better match, but I really think it shows before we start putting the mantle on Big E or start putting the mantle on Axel. It kind of shows their kind of greenness at the same time.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it wasn't the greatest match. I'll agree with that. But I've seen enough from Langston to have some confidence in him going forward with this title. And the thing is with Axel, just. It was a run that was going nowhere. They weren't doing anything with it, and it was time. It was time for a change. I think. And I think Langston's the right guy at the right time.
Well, there's a couple things that I kind of see with this, with everything kind of leading up to Survivor Series, is that you have Big E taking the Intercontinental Championship, and I think you're right. I think they're going to kind of let him kind of be a dominant Intercontinental Champion. You already have that to a small part with the U.S. Championship with Dean, and you know. The conspiracy theorist in me as a wrestling fan is kind of looking at what's going on with the Shield and what's going on with Randy Orton, and then you kind of compare that with what's also going on between the Shield and the Wyatt family, and you can kind of see maybe a face type of turn with these guys. They've been there for a year, you know. It might be a case where it's the avenue's open for them to be a good face squad. Because I think they're getting over, but you know, you have that kind of whole dichotomy with Randy Orton saying, like, oh, you guys are going to have my back, this, that, and this. So everything's set for them to be face. I don't care whether they're face or not, because I like them no matter what, but that can be a direction too. So it might be a way, you know, when we first started this whole podcasting, our second podcast, we're like, dude, what's up with the IC title? What's up with the U.S. belt? There needs to be some legitimacy. Well, now you have a worker in Dean Ambrose that he probably wins about 75% of his matches. And if you're going to have Big E, you know, win 75% of his matches too, then you're kind of bringing back that whole kind of aura of these two belts.
Yeah, and I think I think you're right. Like there's like the slow seeds of some kind of turn, and I think it all will hinge around a slow play between them and the Wyatts. And I think that's the question: which one of those teams ends up being a face? Because they're both really well established as heels right now. I think it probably would make more sense for the Shield to go face than the Wyatts. You can get a lot of mileage out of them in their current format, and I think there's been enough depth shown. And I think most of the depth, I gotta be honest, has been from Roman Reigns. I think like Ambrose has played the straight heel, Rollins has played the straight heel, but Reigns, I mean, he doesn't do anything heel. Like, he doesn't back down. He stands in everyone's face. He fights them straight up. And I think that's the guy, like, it's gonna hinge on at some point. And he's the guy that pretty much tells Randy Orton what's up whenever they're having their little conversations. He's very true to, like, he's a very gray character. Whereas, like, the other two are straight heel. I think he's the grayest out of that group. So I think I see something. Like, Meltzer was speculating that they would slow play that out to play out Wyatt versus Shield at WrestleMania. And if they do, I think that would be great. You get a really good build-up for it, and I think that would, I mean, that might be the only thing that can make me actually interested in buying that pay-per-view, considering all the other rumors of the old-timers that are supposed to be coming back.
So you bring up WrestleMania, and I was kind of thinking about this too, because one of the people that I read, or one of the guys that tweeted it, it might have been, I don't know who it was, but he was saying that he was calling that it was going to be CM Punk versus Daniel Bryan at WrestleMania. And I'm going like, well, isn't this the WrestleMania that CM Punk is supposed to be the headliner? You know, so I'm really thinking that he's not going to be the headliner at WrestleMania. I mean, what do you think? You think it's going to be someone else?
I see no indication that would make me think that he is. I mean, it sounds like there's all sorts of talk that Hogan's going to come back. I think as much as I don't want to have to admit it, you're probably right on the money about John Cena unifying belts. Undertaker's probably going to try to give it a go again.
He's probably going to face Kane again, right? I mean, we've already had about 5 or 6 of them.
I don't know, man. I don't care, to be honest. A lot of speculation that Goldberg might come. There's all these old school guys that they're talking about. Like, you hear, like, these rumblings that they want to, or they're saying they're down to do it.
Ken Shamrock.
Ken Shamrock, I think he signed somewhere. I think he might be going to TNA.
Okay. TNA's still around by then.
Right. And then even, like, the always... You always get that talk that's Sting versus Undertaker, which is, I can't understand why anybody actually would want to see that match in this year, 2014. But there's always that talk. So, I mean, it doesn't look like there's any commitment to CM Punk being anything more than like upper mid card, which, you know, he's doing a great job at it. Like, it's funny watching him now. Like, he does a really good job of being a baby. Like, he still stays to his character. But, like, you're just watching, like, him on the side during that big match, and he's kind of, like, cheerleading for guys, and he's, like, rubbing the gold dust on the head and stuff like that. And it's, like, it's like you know, how Punk has this, like, dark character that he can go to that we really enjoy, but, like, Wayne, he's kind of, like, you know, he has, like, this happy side, too.
Yeah, he has the fanboy student of the game.
Yeah, and character. Like, and when he gets to play that role, like, he does really well at it, too, without, like, sacrificing, like, who he is as a character, so... So I've been as much as he's been de-emphasizing the importance of the show, I've been really enjoying watching the work that he's doing, and I like having him and Daniel Bryan together.
Well, the difference is that when he was the main event and he had Cena be kind of the mid-card guy, Cena, it was just like a throwaway. Whatever he did, it was a throwaway. Whereas CM Punk is really kind of taking the effect. CM Punk and Daniel Bryan are kind of filling the role of Benoit, Dean Malenko, Perry Saturn, Eddie Guerrero, and WCW. They're the backbone of the show. They're the ones that did all the good matches, and these guys are doing it now. And it's not a case where we're sitting going like, oh, man, these guys should be main eventers. I mean, of course they should be, but they're putting on good matches, and whenever you need a main event, you can put these two guys in there, and it works really well.
And the Shield, and the Usos,
yeah.
And the Rhodes.
Yeah, I mean
all
yeah.
Those guys are carrying.
I mean, the roster's there, and you can even...
And for that part, the Wyatt family, too.
And you can even put the Real Americans in there, too,
yeah.
You know, based off of what Cesaro does.
Yeah, their work is good.
Yeah, the work, and that's the difference. You know, when we first started this, you know, we're at Mega Skill number 52. When we first started this, we were saying, like, well... They have all this talent, but they're not using them. Well, now they're using the talent. You know, it's not so much young guys anymore, but they have the talent in place where they can carry a show. And you can kind of, if the main event's something that you don't like, or if it's the opening segment where Triple H comes out, it's like, oh, Triple H and Stephanie McMahon come out again, and they're saying absolutely nothing again. You know, it's like, oh, it's the same retread over and over again. Well, you're going to have a mid part of the show that's going to work really well. And granted, you know, this one had a live performance with two flipping country guys that I don't even know who the hell they were. Like, let's show them how we do business. Like, shut the hell up, dude. I'm like, who the hell are you guys, you know? But, hey, the crowd loved it. I loved it because I got to fast-forward it, and it was good to go.
Little thing. Cesaro, not Cesaro, Sandow and Dolph Ziggler.
I fell asleep during that part.
Did you watch the match?
There was a match?
Yeah.
Sandow versus Ziggler?
Yeah.
And I fell asleep through the whole thing, didn't even know it was there?
Yeah.
I didn't. I thought they were just talking.
No, he put him in a match.
Who won the match?
Ziggler.
Okay. Ziggler won the match? And I missed it?
But, so...
If Ziggler wins a match, he must have been facing Damian Sandow. Yeah. There we go.
So, it's funny. So, like, they called it the broad... Like, you saw the lead-up to it, though, at least, where Triple H was talking. So
I saw the all three of them there. And the second that Triple H started talking, I fell asleep.
Yeah, that will happen.
Seriously.
That will happen.
Yeah.
So he put him in, he called it a Broadway brawl or something. He's like, I don't even know what that means. There's going to be a bunch of instruments. Just do whatever you do. So there's all these instruments in the ring, right? So it was very interesting. The whole match occurred in basically one quarter of the ring. And they got all their moves. They put all their spots and everything. But, like, the instruments were taking up like half the ring, and the whole thing was in a corner. It was done pretty well. But the little thing that I liked, so it was towards the end of the match.
Did Sandow play the tuba or something?
No. Sandow pretty much hit Dolph with pretty much every instrument that he could get his hands on. And then finally, Ziggler had this little comeback, and there was this guitar that I had been eyeballing through the whole way, because Sandow hit him with an electric guitar a few times.
Was it Will and Jennings' guitar or what?
Nah, it was Jess Jarrett's guitar.
Okay.
And the reason why I say that was because right before Dolph hit him with it, he did a homage. He did the double J strut with the guitar in his hand before he did Sandow.
The worst strut ever.
The worst Ric Flair ripoff of all time. But I was down with it because I'm no mark for Jarrett, but I like that Dolph at least knows enough about the history. He's in Tennessee. He's a face. They all love Jeff Jarrett down there. And I think for his part, he gave the crowd what they wanted to see.
I feel bad for Tennessee.
Hey, but I liked it.
Yeah.
So I
got to go back and watch it again.
I mean, yeah.
And because my Raw is saved. And there's a reason why it is saved. But before I get into that...
It had something to do with the Divas musical chairs.
Had nothing to do with that, because I fell asleep during that, too. One thing, so you have the big Miz turn into a heel again, and I'm wondering, I was like, well, what is it about the Miz that I hate so much? I mean, yeah, there's a lot of reasons why I hate the Miz, and the funny thing is I used to like the Miz, but I'm like, why do I dislike this guy so bad? So the first reason why is because they wanted to push him a la Ric Flair and try to, you know, have Ric Flair rub off on this guy and make him like a face, which never worked. They tried to have him kind of be the secondary face of the company to, like, sell to Ion TV for the main event. He was supposed to be the poster boy for that. Didn't work either because he's just a straight cornball. And then you bring in his parents, and his mom is one thing, but his dad is like a whole other different thing, dude. And
we're not going to revisit Mrs. Dad, are we?
But we always got to revisit Mrs. Dad. Right. But, I mean, so that was like another main reason why, too. It's like, man, I'm like, how can you have any respect for a wrestler if his parents were those two people? You know, it's like there must have been a lot of moonshine involved to get the Miz, you know, created that day. You know, because, like...
Well, I think they match each other. I think the parents... Are...
But the whole thing is, like, if, like, the Miz's mom is coming on to his dad, right? And the dad has no expression whatsoever. Like, she takes off her shirt, and he just stands there and doesn't look at that look on his face going, like, oh, what am I supposed to do now?
Bring it on, baby.
He can't even say that. He's like, okay. So it's that. But then it's his haircut, too. I mean, his haircut is, like, straight, like, I can't even, it's a prep boy haircut back that was, like, made.
Like he walked off the set of the Outsiders.
No, because but I like the Outsiders. I like the book at least. No, he's like a you know what it is? It's like, you remember Son of a Woman? It's like a prep boy haircut, dude. So like every time I see him with that, he bugs his eyes out. Like even like when you try to do the whole tag to Kofi, and he like bugs his eyes out. He's like, oh, I'm not gonna tag you. And then he gets off the ring, and his hair is flopping all over the place. Just looks like a flipping idiot. He's like, he needs to go back to like a buzz cut or something. You know, it's like he needs to like get some drunk chick and sleep with some drunk chick like he used to on the real world World Rules Challenge and stuff and everything like that. You know, it's like he needs to go back to that, because then I'll start kind of maybe start liking him just a little bit. But he's just a waste of time, dude.
I mean, that was quite possibly the most anticlimactic heel turn in the history of the business. Nobody cared about it. It had zero impact. It wasn't even that good of a setup. The match made no sense to begin with. The only thing I will give them any kind of credit for was I did find it interesting that his initial face turn did involve Kofi Kingston as well, right? So it did come full circle. I mean, that's not much, you know, that gets the Barry Horowitz pat on the back, but aside from that, I mean, I can't think of any heel or face turn that had less impact than that right there.
You have two guys that are just floundering with their characters, and nobody likes them. I mean, it's so bad that Kofi's coming out with a do-rag, dude. You know, and do-rags haven't been... Well, popular since
it's just the things like
Durex haven't been popular since Kid and Play when they had those three rappers and that guy with the you know, what was the name of that house party?
Yeah,
the house party dude with the do-rag. I mean, that's when that stuff was popular, you know.
Yeah, but it's just, I mean, he's got a stale character, like very, very stale. but like all he thinks he's gonna fix it with wardrobe changes. It's like he's still the same character, he's still the same guy. You know, he puts on a good match. I'm not gonna take that away from Kofi, but the guy's never gonna move forward if he can't like reinvent himself in at least some way. You know, a lot of the same criticisms that we had given for Cena over the course of this this podcast series, and you say all the same stuff about Kofi Kingston, and probably even worse. So, yeah, I don't, you know, he needs to reinvent himself. He needs to go back to the drawing board and do something different, because he can try to call himself a Wildcat, or he can switch from blue to green to orange.
And I can fly and all
yeah,
that
but
crap.
Nothing else that he's doing, nothing he's doing in the ring, personality wise or anything, nothing's different. And that's what his problem is, and the Miz too. The Miz is a one trick pony, and the one trick he has isn't very good. He can't even at least Kofi gets it done in the ring.
Yeah,
which you can't even say that about the Miz.
Yeah, no, the Miz. At least like when he first had his heel run, he had some type of personality, mm-hmm. and whether you liked his personality or not, like it kind of worked. But what really hindered him with that working was that he was just bad in the ring. I mean, his signature moves are really bad. I think the only time he was ever good is when he was with John Morrison. That was it, and it's really sad when you have a guy that has no personality in John Morrison making The Miz a better person.
Yeah. Well, like for a guy The Miz's size and build, you better be a technician or you better be fucking balls on the mic, and he sucks on the mic.
Yeah,
and there was a time where like you said, like his shtick on the mic worked, but it hasn't worked for a long time. And if he just tries to go back to what he was doing as a heel 4 years ago, he's not gonna take off again either.
So before we get into the whole reason why I'm keeping Raw, Ryback and Big Show, what did you think about that match?
I thought it was pretty interesting, actually. I was shocked that Ryback got him up for whatever his finisher was.
Because he couldn't give it Tensai up.
Right. Or Heyman. Right?
Yeah, because both those guys are stiff.
Yeah, but I was impressed that he was able to get Big Show up. I kind of have a problem with Big Show kicking out of that move. If anybody's going to feel damaged from a move like that, it should be the Big Show, being that he weighs like 450 pounds. Should have more impact on him than most anybody else. So for that part, I kind of felt like I don't really understand why he no-sold on that move.
Why he John Cena that move?
Yeah, but aside from that, I mean, the match was probably about as good as you could expect it to be from those two guys.
So you think, because I've always kind of said that I really thought that Big Show really brought back Randy Orton with the matches that he did. Is Big Show, are we not giving this guy enough credit for putting on good matches? Because the guy does put on good matches. And it's not a simple case where he's bigger than everybody else so he can overpower anybody else. But he bumps really well for what he does. And yeah, it was impressive that Ryback put him up in his finishing move. But I really think it shows how weak that his finisher is. I mean, it's a glorified like Samoan drop, you know, and it's, I think it's more effective if the guy's small, because at least he can get some air on it. But I don't think it's that hard for a guy like Ryback to put that guy up on his shoulders, because it's like a squat, you know, the guy can squat, you know, so I don't think it's that hard of a move to actually like put a big guy on. But I think it really showed how weak that move kind of is. But I thought the match was good. I mean, I thought Ryback did a really good job in that match, and I think a lot of it has to do, I'd probably give like Big Show 70% of that match and Ryback a 30. But there's something there, you know. It wasn't a match where I was looking like, oh man, this match is so boring. It was actually a really interesting match.
And I think that's good for Ryback. I think Ryback's getting better. I mean, he's no great.
What'd you just say?
I think he's getting better. I mean,
really?
Yeah. That doesn't, you know, from where he started from, that doesn't have to take a whole lot. But I think he's developing a little bit of a personality in the ring. Anytime he kind of he tries to put a phrase together, it's extremely forced. But like he's getting a little bit of a smack talk in the ring, and I think he's getting a little bit better.
Well, I think that in all fairness to Ryback, they put him in every bad situation possible. You know, they try to make him a monster baby face, and just got really boring really fast. No personality, kind of like a John Cena clone in that type of respect, where he has his set moves and the crowd would cheer for certain spots, like his meat hook, and he'd start pumping his arms. So, you know, true wrestling fans are never going to like a character like that. And then he had these, like, crazy promos where he's just a bully and, like, some guy's trying to eat, like, a fillet of fish. And, like, he slams it in his face and then he takes a bite out of it and stuff and everything. So he was always put in bad spots. And then you kind of put him with Paul Heyman. And then Paul Heyman, you know, proposes to him. He's like, man, what the hell is this? So he's always been put in bad spots. I think this is, like, the first time where he was actually kind of... I mean, we liked him. We liked him when he was part of Nexus. I mean, I thought he was kind of the whole linchpin of the Nexus. And when he got hurt, I think the Nexus really fell apart because of that.
Yeah. No, I agree. And I think that had the main reason was because Wade Barrett was doing the talking. And I think, like I said, like he's best served as the muscle of some kind of faction. I thought that the Heyman thing was probably should have been the best thing for him. I don't know exactly why it fell apart. I mean,
it was for a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, they did some stupid things like that proposal and all that. And so I don't know if Ryback was forced on Heyman and he just started going sideways because he didn't like the whole angle, or what the deal was. But I thought that kind of having a mouthpiece like that was probably the best thing for Ryback. It didn't work out. He seems to be kind of picking up the pieces. I read that he had heat in the back too, so this isn't too unexpected. But I would think that the best thing that he could have going now, and I think he should lose these matches, but I think him and Langston should go at it. I mean, he should try to drop down and go at Langston for the Intercontinental belt. Like, physically, it's a good matchup. They're both even. You know, if he wins a couple non-title matches, like, it's legit, and it's not. I don't think it's going to hurt Langston. But they have a good feud, and Langston comes out on top. I think both of them could be better for it.
Yeah, and the good news with Ryback is that he is facing guys that can make him look good. CM Punk makes him look good. I thought Big Show really made him look good. The logic behind it wasn't really that good because this is the take-home show, and I thought Ryback came across a whole lot better than Big Show did. But it was a good match, and... I was fine with it. I was pleasantly surprised with that match. Let's just say that. So the main reason why my Raw has been saved, usually I'll delete it because, you know, I got the DVR and I don't got a lot of space in my DVR because my kids are like putting like Wizards of Waverly Place and you have Good Luck Charlie and Super Ninjas and
I have no idea what you're talking
exactly.
about.
Exactly. Yeah, and be glad that you don't know what I'm talking about. But this just takes up all my DVR space. But so I knew we were doing the podcast tonight. I didn't see the main event because I passed out. And then so about 7:35 in the morning, we have to leave about 8 o'clock. I put the main event on, and we were all ready to go. So my girls started watching it, and they were just enthralled by this match. I mean, they really liked it. And it was a very good match. I liked the whole kind of Shield aspect of not tagging the Wyatt family and stuff and everything. That was really good. But the last, of course, again, the last 5 minutes of all these tag matches are just spot after spot after spot after spot. And, you know, I said a couple weeks ago that Goldust is the best hot tag in the business. I think after this match, I still think he's the best hot tag in the business. CM Punk was very good. But he got tired real fast. I mean, it was...
Yeah, but that neck breaker...
The neck breaker, of course.
Shit.
And that's the whole thing. My daughter was saying, she's like, save that match. I want to see it again. You know, and this is my older daughter. She's like, and we're like walking to the car and we're driving to school. She's like, man, she's like, CM Punk was at the right place at the right time. And, you know, he did all this stuff. And here's like a 9-year-old girl like breaking down the match. And it was just really kind of neat to like hear her like kind of become a fan of wrestling and start kind of recognizing the spots and what things were going on. And then all Rey Mysterio thing aside, you know, which of course... I was thinking about you the whole time when he comes out, and just the moves that he did, it's just terrible. Like the first guy that got put on the rope was it was a Shield guy, right? Or was it both Wyatt guys? It was a Shield guy.
Well, I mean, the first thing he did, he slid through somebody's legs, and then he went and. Yeah, then he went and flipped some guy twice.
And the guy totally had to sell it, and yeah. Lands on the rope, and then he does a move to
And then the famous move where he's sitting there on the ropes, and Rowan runs from the other side of the ring, and Rey Mysterio pulls the rope down 2 inches, so Rowan has to fly over it.
Yeah.
Right? And then he comes with the double 619 on.
Yeah.
And it's just like, dude, I don't have the words, right?
Yeah.
It's like, why are you gonna, you had six guys. that are monsters that, you know, you've built up for a year in one case and for about 6 months in the other. Monsters, they're beating up everybody, and then you're going to get this little 5'3" fuck come through and just kick all their asses with a bunch of high flyer shit. Like that, like, again, I always go back to this, like, that whole, like, luchador, like, fad in WCW, for me, was a big part that killed that company. And to go back to that, like, just no logic kind of, we're going to have this little guy come through and take all these guys out with these moves that everyone knows can never really be done. There's just no reason for it. I mean, I know they're doing it because they're going to try to put him in. He's going to be, like,
Survivor Series.
He's going to be the last guy, and I mean, I think it's all dumb. But, yeah, it just makes no sense to me why they think this is the spot to put this guy in. Why they keep bringing this guy back at all. I mean, he doesn't bring anything to the table.
Well, the one thing I looked at with Rey Mysterio is I looked at his size. You know, not his height, but I looked at his weight. And he looks like he's slimmed down. And the whole thing is that when you have a beefed up Rey Mysterio, it doesn't work. Because, you know, the guy, whenever you see a beefed up Rey Mysterio, you know the guy's on roids like crazy. You know, so I was kind of looking at it, I was like, well, the Rey Mysterio that I kind of liked way back when was a small, skinny guy that was super fast. And it kind of made his stuff more believable because he was a small, skinny guy. He was fast. He could outspeed everybody. And when he got all yoked up, it's like, well, he's trying to do the same stuff, but it just doesn't look right. You know, he's trying to be a small man in a big man's game, and you're taking away any credibility with him trying to be a big guy or you know, all yoked out. It kind of takes away any semblance of logic that you can have with this guy. So he has slimmed down a little bit, but the more I looked at him, I was like, you know what, that could probably be El Torito right there. You know, El Torito is pretty small, but yeah, it might be Rey Mysterio. You never know. You know, you always have the kind of the whole thing that, you know, the Undertaker, when he first came, there's a new Undertaker and there's an old Undertaker, and there's no way that the new Undertaker is the old Undertaker. It's kind of the same thing with El Torito and Rey Mysterio. It's like, well, maybe he is El Torito. You never know.
Yeah, I'm gonna continue to doubt that one. But, yeah, I mean, I'd rather see El Torito in a match at this point than Rey Mysterio. Yeah, that the whole thing bothers me.
Yeah, no, it does. I mean, you knew he was coming back, and he comes back, and it's just the same shtick over and over again. I mean, it's like...
Look, I'll take it this far. For the 3 minutes that I saw Brad Maddox in a match, it was 100 times more compelling than anything Rey Mysterio did. I thought Brad Maddox did pretty good.
Yeah.
And I don't know why when after he hit Orton with the mic, and Orton was laying there, and he had a chair right in front of him, I don't know why he didn't pick it up and go to work. But aside from that, I thought he played that whole role great. I thought he, for the parts that he got to do a spot, I thought he looked good. He took a beating like a man. I was pretty impressed.
It was the best time that when Orton, steals some guy's tweet, when Orton started hitting Brad Max over the head like 10 times with the mic.
With a microphone or a phone.
Yeah, it was the best time that Randy Orton's ever been on the mic.
I thought Orton did good on the mic. I thought all his promos were good this week.
Yeah.
And I think it's good, like, we've been talking about him kind of separating himself from Triple H and being his own guy and his own heel. And I thought he showed a lot of signs towards doing that. Like, even last week, too. So for the last 2 weeks, I thought Randy Orton, letting him be kind of his own guy, has worked for it, for his character.
So I should give him a chance, is that what you're saying? Give the guy a chance?
I would. I don't think there's anything that he's done that's been bad. I think that putting him alongside Triple H and trying to build up Triple H has kind of stalled the momentum that he had. But any time that they said, here's your ball, Randy, go run with it, I think that his performances in the ring have been good, and on the mic he's been good, too.
What about even with this whole promo that, you know, ladies want to be with me and guys want to be me? You know, that whole promo that he did?
See, cause was that the one right before the pay-per-view?
No, maybe. I don't know.
The promo he did before the pay-per-view I thought was pretty bad. But again, he was sitting there with the shield.
It was right after the pay-per-view.
Okay, yeah, I don't remember that.
Because, I mean, sometimes he goes back to, like, heel 101 and tries to, like, play a certain heel role that really doesn't work. And, you know, yeah, I think the jury's still on this guy. I mean, because the whole thing is that we were, before he kind of lined up with Triple H and stuff, I mean, there was a lot of potential there when he first lined up with Triple H, you know, where he could be the face of the company and Triple H could play the back role and kind of be like a Paul Heyman type role. Mm-hmm. And then Triple H, of course, being Triple H, kind of takes over everything and he pushes everybody off to the side, which really kind of stalled anything that Randy Orton could do. So, yeah.
All right. So, there's, I don't know how I want to approach this next one. So there's two ways. I think I want to start talking about this group, and then I want to lead it into kind of like what we were doing last week. So this is kind of the last recap of this past week. I've been pretty impressed with the three-man band, dude. I thought the Union Jack thing was pretty damn funny, and I thought their Rhinestone Cowboy thing worked for this week. So, like, even though they jobbed, well, they did. I think they did win one match in England. I had to fast forward the match that they went against Matadors because Santino was involved, and you know, I got my principles. But their work's pretty good in the ring, and just them having these corny gimmicks, I think it works.
With them on the mic on Raw doing that promo before the match. And we were saying this before. I don't know if we said it on podcast or if we said we might have been sitting outside after we're done with the podcast.
On the stoop.
And you know, when they first did the whole three-man band thing, I thought that worked really well. And they gave him some promo time, and I thought Jinder just like nailed it. He's like, "I'm the funny one of the group," and he just gives like this cold stare. Yeah, and it really worked. I mean, it really there's like this vibe there with him. Mm-hmm. And then they totally like got away from it where they just started jobbing the whole time.
Right.
And when these three guys are on the mic, if you give these guys mic time. They're all good. Jinder was really good on the mic, and then you had the I'm sorry if
the Sinister Scotsman.
Yeah, and he was good on the mic, and just it all worked, and the Carrot Top was good too. So, I mean, if you give these guys more mic time, I think you have something there, and it's I think that's what really made who's the main guy.
Slater.
I mean, Slater, before he led up to the three-man band, he was the one-man band. And it was before, like, the big, 500 episode of Raw or whatever, and he was facing all these, like, former, like, legends and stuff. Those were very entertaining segments. And, yeah, he jobbed, but he was coming out on top of that whole segment thing.
Yeah, no, he was winning the day every time.
Yeah.
And, like, he actually won a couple matches against, like, really bad old guys. And then he got squashed on a bunch, but dude was funny every time.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, these other two latched onto that character, that gimmick, and like I thought it had
the first like 2-3 weeks, that gimmick was really good.
Yeah,
the theme music, you're finally coming around to that theme music because of the video game, but that theme music is good, dude. I like it, and the whole air guitar thing they were doing, it worked, man. Yeah. And I wouldn't mind seeing more of that stuff. I'd rather see them like do a different gimmick every week and give them some mic time. Mm-hmm. And see what they can do with it, because they're going
to
get over.
You think that's the way to go every week? Just keep rotating gimmick.
As in the WWE universe, the way that it is, yeah. I don't think you should have to do that. I think if you just give these guys mic time, they're going to shine, because they have, every time they get on the mic, they do shine. But the WWE, they don't allow you to do that. So if it's a case where they have to change their gimmick up every flipping week wherever they are, I'm all for it. Because instead of them just being jobbers, it's like there's some like compelling, something compelling about them where you want to watch them from week to week to week.
Yeah, and you know, as much as they're these cowardly heels, like they were super over in the UK with the Union Jack gimmick, and I think they were pretty over.
I think they're over in the IWC too.
Yeah,
yeah. I think people liked them as Union Jacks. And it gives them something to talk about.
Well, yeah, but I mean, I think they were over in Tennessee as well with the stuff that they were wearing this time. I thought it was pretty funny. All right, so yeah, good. We're on the same page there. So that's going to segue into, you know, last week we kind of talked about, like, we compared factions of today versus ones we grew up looking at, and some of the top guys also. But we didn't really talk about the jobbers. And I want to take a look at, like, the evolution of the jobber. Right, like, so back when we were first watching, like, there was a couple of jobbers that I think were really well known. They didn't have much of a gimmick, right? They didn't take time to develop these guys. They just came out and they lost every week. Guys that I'm thinking of is, like, I mentioned him earlier, but one, Barry Horowitz.
Yeah.
Brooklyn Brawler, for his own part, Terry Taylor, the Red Rooster as well. Never had much kind of character development, much gimmicks. They came out, you knew they were going to lose. Today you have these jobbers that they have a gimmick. They kind of build them up so you can at least kind of think that they're supposed to be something. Or sometimes they get this minor belt so that they can come back and say, "Oh, that guy's a former United States champion." So I just think it's kind of interesting. Like guys I'm thinking today, like Santino, three-man bands, pretty much just a job group. And those are the ones I was thinking of, like modern. But it's a lot different the way they play these jobbers out today. And I don't know, do you like the jobbers of today with a little bit of a story and a little bit of a gimmick? Or do you like the guys back in the day that, like, you knew those guys were never going to get a chance to get over?
I probably like the guys back in the day, and I'm going to introduce two more. One of them, and this isn't the main guy, but one of them is George South. George South always made me laugh. He would job in WCW, he would job in WWF, and the guy was just like, he just looked at the lights the whole time. I mean, George, it's just like, dude, who the hell is George South? You know, like, who is this guy, right? Like, George South. That's all I got to say is George South. But the other guy was Leaping Lanny Poffo. And he would have the Frisbees before he became the model. But this guy
would... The genius.
Yeah, I'm sorry, the genius, yeah. But he would have the Frisbees, I think, as Leaping Lanny Poffo. And he would write poems on the Frisbees, and he'd throw the Frisbees out. And I thought Leaping Lanny... And I think the difference is that these guys were in the business for a long time. Like, you knew they could get the job done in the ring. Like, George South... As funny as I like to bag on the guy, he was an accomplished technician, if I can say so, in the ring. Like, you know, he went from territory to territory, and he made a good living off of being a jobber. Leaping Lanny, I thought, was a great technician in the ring, and he always, you know, I still remember to this day, Demolition, I'm not impressed. If it wasn't for Mr. Fuji, you two couldn't get dressed. And then Demolition gets all mad and kicks his ass and stuff and anything like that. So the problem with jobbers today is that they make them win every now and then, like Santino. Like, they'll give Santino a run, and he had a run as U.S. champion, and it's like, dude, I'm like, what the hell is this? And the guy I want to compare it to is like a guy like Barry Horowitz, because Barry Horowitz got a run too. Barry Horowitz with Hakushi had a 10-minute run.
As tag team champion?
It wasn't a tag team champion. It was just a case of, he even had his own shirt, because, you know, Barry Horowitz, he would pat his back and stuff. He'd do a good move and pat himself on the back, and then he'd get his ass kicked, right?
Did his shirt come with its own suspenders?
It might have. but I know there's a big old handprint on the back, yeah. And he would tap it and stuff, and he was over a little bit. So
people like Barry Horowitz.
People like Barry.
I like Barry Horowitz. Dude. Yeah. I knew he was going to get his ass kicked, but he took his beating like a man.
I like George South.
Yeah. I mean, he was funny. Like, you know, the way he acted like he was sure he was going to win.
He wasn't forced. Right. Like, Santino was forced.
Right.
To a small part, 3MB, before they started doing this whole gimmick run, they were forced, you know, because they're forced, like, you know, they try to give him a gimmick that never really worked. Barry Horowitz never had a gimmick. He had to kind of come up with his own gimmick to, like, stay within the company and be a jobber. George South definitely never had a gimmick, but he was always in every match on Saturday morning. Poffo, Leaping Lanny, he had a gimmick, but when it was like a smaller show, like, say, like Saturday Superstars or like the afternoon Saturday show, the guy would put on like a 15-20 minute match, and he'd win every now and then. Yeah. But it wasn't forced. It's like, this guy's pretty good, yeah. You know. Like, you know that it's kind of like the whole Hall of Kayfabe thing, right? It's like, this guy is good, but he's not going to get a push to be any type of major superstar. Now with the way everything's scripted now, it's like, you know, these guys are like, you know they're not good. You know you don't like them, but Santino's going to get a run, and when Santino got his run, did you enjoy it? No, you hated it. When Horowitz got his run, it's like, man, this guy's been losing for the past 10 years. He's finally getting a run. But not only that, he's elevating a guy like Hakushi, mm-hmm. who's like was a great wrestler, and they were like friends for a while, and they had this little promo where Barry Horowitz was trying to teach him how to speak English and stuff and try to help him out and stuff. And he had a nice little year run, and it was a lot more effective during that time. So I like the jobbers of old.
Like the jobbers of
old. Yeah, way better.
Any other jobbers you want to bring up? I got one that comes to mind that is really enjoyable to watch. Jimmy Wang Yang, dude. That guy,
I like Jimmy Wang Yang.
He's a pretty good jobber. Yeah.
Jimmy Wang Yang was...
That dude could put on a good match.
I liked his gimmick, too. I mean, his entrance video was awesome, dude. He's wearing the cowboy hat, and you know, it didn't make any sense. but the guy could get... He worked good in the ring. And the whole thing is that he was part of...
Kai and Tai?
It wasn't Kai and Tai. He was, in WCW, there was the Young Dragons.
The Young Dragons?
Yeah, the Young Dragons, yeah. And he was the best guy out of all those three, and he was really skinny back then.
Well, they did have a... a gaijin posing as a Japanese
wrestler. Yeah, and he worked for a while in
WWE. Jamie Noble.
Yeah.
That guy. And that he worked in the time when they actually had cruiserweights. That guy was good. That guy worked.
Yeah. No. Yeah. Wang Yang I liked, and, you know, I've always liked that guy. Yeah. I even created him in a creative wrestler spot. Because I just liked the guy, because I remember him in WCW, and I liked his whole, he had like this move where he had like all these like karate punches and stuff and like that, worked really well, and then he got all yoked out, you know, during the kind of the last hurrah of the steroid era, and I think he kind of got lost in the shuffle, but I liked Wang Yang. So maybe I like the old jobbers, but, you know, if you're going to put Wang Yang in there, maybe it kind of inches more towards the...
Well, he's like, I mean, I think... What we did last week, we talked about like now, and then we kind of compared with the 80s, but we really skipped the Attitude Era and the 90s. He'd be more of like a jobber from the Attitude Era, from that late 90s, early 2000s period.
Yeah, and then in NWA, you always had that black dude with the Jerry curls. I don't even know what his name was, but he was always like you look back to like the old like kind of whenever they show like either like old Four Horsemen stuff or say. That Buzzsaw dude or whatever.
Buzz Sawyer,
yeah. He'd always fight like this like black dude with like these jerry curls. It's just this little skinny, like yoked out guy. But yeah, it's like you knew who the jobbers were, and when they finally the difference is, I think, why I like the jobbers of old is because you knew these guys were like living like match to match. Mm-hmm. And they were living like paycheck to paycheck. It's kinda like the whole like Dusty Rhodes kind of thing. He's like, you know, oh, you know, when you're a winner, you get to the pay window, and, you know, and you get the winner's bounty and stuff and everything like that. Mm-hmm. Well, that's actually kind of what it was. I mean, not in actuality, but you knew these guys were like just making a living, making an honest living. Where the jobbers now, they're guaranteed contracts. They're getting paid a lot better than you and I will ever be.
It's harder to identify a jobber today, and you knew exactly who the jobbers were back then, and. A guy can go from today being a world champion to being a jobber in a matter of months. Jack Swagger would be a great example of that.
Dolph Ziggler would be a great example of that too.
Dolph Ziggler, yeah. Well,
Damian Sandow.
Dolph Ziggler was a jobber while he was a champion, unfortunately. But yeah, no, I just I don't know. I like thinking about the jobbers. Like, you know, sometimes I think about these guys. Like, and that was kind of like with the young Stallions, right? Like,
yeah.
I kind of like some of these guys, and it's hard. It's that balance of
putting Paul Roma, the job guy from WWE,
and Jimmy Powers, man. Don't forget about Jimmy Powers. But yeah, it's like it's kind of borderline whether they're Hall of Kayfabe material. But I like to recognize some of these guys because that's part of growing up watching wrestling too. Is like we had the guys we really liked and the guys that we thought were good and all that. But then you had this steady row of jobbers that you knew who the hell these guys were. Like if I'm walking down the mall and I seen Barry Horowitz, I'd probably mark when I was like 10 years old, even though I knew the guy sucked.
You'd probably mark now.
Yeah, I might.
Hey, Barry, I remember when you used to job to this guy all the time. Yeah.
And Brooklyn Brawler, too, man. Like, the Brawler, like, he just got his ass kicked for about 10 years straight, and then I think he got some really small mini run, like, late in his career.
Yeah, with the Heenan family.
Yeah, and now he's one of the, like, road agents, right?
Yeah,
like,
I mean, he's made a good name for himself. Yeah. He was... for a while, he was the head of WWE DVDs. You know, like the guy that he would have to get all the interviews and stuff, and he would get in Jericho's face too. He's like, "Hey, I'm not doing this because I want to. You know, it's like I'm doing this because, you know, corporate wants people to be on these DVDs to help." So he's like, "I'm just trying to sell these DVDs and tell stories of these guys." And it's like, you kind of need to do it. And when Jericho kind of said, "Okay, I kind of have to do it," that's when Jericho started kind of. Being seen in a better light within the company. So Lombardi's done a great job of himself, you know, and it's good to see these jobbers, like even like Alice Radley, she has her own podcast, like,
right.
And she interviewed Leaping Lanny Poffo, you know, she interviewed, what's his name? What's his real name? Lanny Poffo. Yeah. So she interviewed him and the guy, I mean, it's kind of like, you know, like Jim Rome when he does interviews, right? And he always says, like, dude, he's like, when I interview offensive linemen, he's like, that's the best interview in the business. Well, these guys, I mean, Poffo was a great interview. I'm like, I listened to the whole thing. I'm like, man, this guy is just amazing, you know? And she had some guy that was kind of on there too, kind of doing the interview. And the guy was just like an awe. And I was like, dude, I'm like, ask him all these questions, dude. It's like, you got a flipping jobber right here. He's seen all this stuff. Like, instead of just saying, like, well, I'm totally anon, I'm like, fuck that, dude. Like, ask this guy some stuff, you know? Ask him about the flipping frisbees. Ask him about all this stuff. So, you know, it's kind of a case where, like, these guys had to go through, you know, they're like the last vestige of the territory days. And everything that they did, like, George South came out with his own book. I've never read it. But, I mean, he's made a life for himself, you know, outside of business. And I always kind of remember George South because Flair one time was saying that he was supposed to do a match with someone. The guy didn't want to do business. So he's like, well, give me George South. He's like, I'll make George South the top face in the company for this match right here. Mm-hmm. And they went through all the spots. And George South was saying, like, hey, man, he's like, if I could do a flash pin and and hold the guy down for 3 seconds and walk away with the belt, he's like, I would have done it. You know, so it's like, you know, it's just a Flair saw enough in this guy that this guy was a worker. He's like, I'm going to make you look like $1 million. What I did to Sting, I'm going to do to you. So it's like you always have these guys that can do the job. And the one guy we even had like kind of a Twitter conversation one time, and it was a guy in bringing up Survivor Series.
Sam Houston.
I don't think it was Sam Houston.
No, we were trying. That was the name I had.
Yeah, but it was a different guy.
Yeah.
But that guy, like, it's sad, I don't even know this guy's name. We actually found out who it was at the end. But this guy had a fill-in, I think, might have been for Dino Bravo or something. And the guy, you know, because the guy didn't want to do business. So this guy came in, and I think he, like, eliminated, like, one or two guys. And we're sitting there after Survivor Series, and we're like, man, who the hell is this guy? This guy's really good, you know, but he was a straight jobber. And it's like, man, this guy should get a run. You know, he's like, we need to find out who this guy is so we can put him in the Hall of Kayfabe. But the guy was awesome. I was like, dude, I'm like, who the fuck is this guy? This guy's really good. And it just shows, like, these guys that were jobbers way back when, they knew how to wrestle. The jobbers now, not so much. You know, you look at a guy like Santino, he's not a good wrestler. You know?
He's terrible.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I think for the most part, the 3MB they can all go. So, I think the guys are a lot more athletic today. Like your bottom feeder guys are going to be better than the bottom feeder.
You can be athletic as you want, but if you don't have the ring psychology,
right,
and you can't make a match flow, it doesn't matter how athletic you are. And that was the difference between the jobbers back then, is that they knew ring psychology, they knew how to make the other person look good, and that's what's kind of missed from today.
Yeah, and I think it goes back to that they don't bring anybody in to be a jobber anymore. Like they may end up being a jobber. But they don't bring them in with the idea that these guys are going to job, right?
Yeah, they think enhancement talent.
Well, everybody's a superstar, quote superstar now. And then if they end up deciding that they're going to job the guy out, they job him out. But yeah, no, I do miss the jobbers of the old days. What about Coco? You think Coco was a jobber?
Coco had a nice run, but then he started. I mean, he did beat what
Butch Reed,
right? I mean, for a while, I mean, Coco was. Coco for a while was—he was one of the hottest guys in the business. I was a big Coco fan,
but I just don't ever really remember him winning much.
He did a tag team called High Energy, with one Hart family member.
Owen?
Oh yeah,
the Blazer.
It was a Blue Blazer. They had like these neon pants and checkers and stuff, and they were called High Energy for a while.
Oh, I remember the checkers. Yeah, with the neon.
Yeah,
I didn't know he was teaming with. I thought that was just his thing at the time.
No,
he was still Birdman when he was doing that, right? Was that pre-Bird?
He might have been. But
yeah, he had to be.
Hey, Coco for a while. Coco, he jogged, but for a while when he was having a nice little run, man, that guy had those crazy-ass glasses on, and the guy was styling, dude. Yeah. You know, stymie.
The guy can still do a lot of high-flying stuff for as thick as he was.
Yeah. No. Coco was so good that they had that one video game. Where it was just a quarter eating machine.
Yeah,
it was called was it Saturday Night Main Event?
That's the one I got thrown out of 7-Eleven because I was yelling too much.
Yeah, yeah. No. That was a different game. That was the one with the Make Powers and
yeah.
But it was the other one. It had a little button. You'd have to slam on the button really hard. You get blisters and cuts all over your hands because you're slamming on that thing so hard. But Coco was one of the guys in there, and the guy was tight, dude. I mean, Coco had a nice look to him. So I think let's go ahead.
That was the one where it wasn't really a WWE sanctioned game, so they had all the wrestlers that were like supposed to be the real guys, like Haku was in there, but he was the Maui Mauler,
right? Yeah.
That was that game, right?
Yeah,
I remember.
That's Saturday Night Main Event.
But no, because they didn't. That wasn't a. They took all the images, but they didn't have any licenses.
It was Saturday Night Main Event or something.
Yeah, it couldn't have any WWE name.
Way back when, but you'd have to put quarters in all the time.
Yeah.
And if you got down to zero, the guy would just fall on the ground.
Yeah.
So you're looking at it's not crumpled today. So I think we can, we're getting up, dude. So I think we can get into the Hall of Kayfabe right now.
Okay. You got any money?
We're talking about all these jobbers, man. I'm having delusions of grandeur of like who I should put in. I don't know. Do you have anybody?
I do. The pool's getting a little shallow, but there's a couple of names that I think are worthy.
Okay.
But if you got somebody, I'm throwing them out most of the time. I've only vetoed you once.
I'm just saying, like, we're talking about all these jobbers right now, and there's a lot of, you know. Yeah, I got it. Well, I don't know if this guy really... He can probably fit the bill.
He's got to be better than Paul Roma.
Oh, wait, he's way better than Paul Roma. I think we need to put in Ron Simmons in the Hall of Kayfabe. Because he had that run...
He's not in?
He's not in, no.
You sure?
I'm pretty sure he's not in. If it's questionable, then maybe we shouldn't put him in, but... Maybe we can ask the producer.
Yeah, we're going to have to go back on the archives. I think Simmons is in.
Is Simmons in?
I think he is. He's one of the early inductions.
Well,
I remember talking about him.
Yeah. You know, off the top of my head, I'm trying to think of a guy. It'd probably have to be a WCW guy.
If you can't do it, I'll
throw him in. Yeah, go ahead. I mean, because I'm thinking George South. I think Coco is a good guy to be in there, too. I think Ron Simmons is just because I think that guy never got his due in the ring.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Simmons, I think he's in. So we'll do the research. If Simmons isn't in, then he can go in next week. Because
I got the guy. Greg the Hammer Valentine.
All right.
Yeah. You know, it's funny because he's a guy you love to make fun of, but this guy just a straight worker. I mean, just a straight wrestler. And the funny thing is, like, we saw this guy. He was at like a WonderCon in San Francisco. And we never went up to him. It's like, oh, you know, because I kind of felt bad for him, dude. You know, he's like hawking his autographs and stuff.
Well, I just didn't want to have to talk to the honky tonk man.
Yeah, yeah, the honky kind of ruined it, huh? Tonky.
If I was going to talk to anybody, it was going to be Aaron Gray.
Aaron Gray, which you couldn't even do. I mean, I had it all set up.
Hey, man, I was all, hey, yeah, I froze. What can I say, man?
Didn't I talk to her for a little bit or something? No, I said hi to her or something, didn't I?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
I think you just made fun of me.
Very easy to do. So getting back to Greg the Hammer. Kind of funny how this guy's kind of career played out. So it kind of started off, and I'm not, don't take this to the bank, but his career really took off when his dad, I think it was Johnny Valentine, got hurt in the plane crash. He got paralyzed for life in the plane crash.
The Ric Flair one?
The Ric Flair plane crash. And so they kind of paired up Valentine with Flair, and they were a tag team for a while, and they were a really good tag team. And the one thing that Flair always kind of said was like, man, this guy was just a snail, dude. Like, he always took his time with everything. He was really slow getting ready. But and you look at this guy, and I remember the very first thing you think about this guy, Pillsbury Doughboy. You know, he just didn't look like a wrestler. Just like...
That's the second thing I think of.
Second was the first... You think of the Heartbreaker, right?
Shin Guard, man.
The Shin Guard, yeah, the Heartbreaker.
Shin Guard, yeah.
Yeah, was that called it was called the Heartbreaker because he was with Jimmy Hart for a while, right?
Yeah, him and Bruce Beefcake were tag team champions.
Yeah.
I think the Dream Team, right? They were the Dream Team.
Were they
right?
The Dream Team?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just the... And the other thing, too, that, you know, we talk about... You know, a lot of people forget, but, you know, Valentine would come out with the same robes that Flair came out with. The exact same person that made Ric Flair's robes, he came out, too. It was just like a harkening back to, like, you know... You look nice when you walk out to the ring. You have like these kick ass robes that are like $6,000-$7,000, which is no stretch of hyperbole whatsoever. That's how much these things cost. The guy was just a throwback guy, could really get it done in the ring. He had a lot of the same spots. I don't know if it was from Flair, but both these guys had the same spot: punch, punch, punch. You know, they get punched on, they'd walk a little bit, fall flat on their face, and that always worked. And I thought Valentine, to a small part, did a little bit better than Flair did. Because Flair was such a high-level guy.
Who's figure four did you like better?
Oh, Flair all the way. But the gimmick...
The gimmick made it happen.
The gimmick
though, right?
Made it happen. And it was just... He got to that point with that gimmick, with that shin guard. And I think the guy that really killed that whole gimmick was Rugged Ronnie Garvin. You know, he had the other shin guard, you know, to block it and stuff, and he could reverse it. But whatever it was, but for a while, he was like a monster heel. Like, you couldn't get past that flipping shin guard.
Yeah.
And you want to talk about, like, jobbers. I mean, he was there every week and fighting some jobber, and the jobber would make him look good. He'd make the jobber look good. Just an old-school type wrestler. Never got his due, and I think it's more because of his look. But, you know, he comes from a strong family background. I mean... Johnny Valentine was a huge guy in the South way back when, mm-hmm. And he kind of had to take the mantle of his son. Two totally different guys. I mean, Johnny Valentine, you know, at that time looked really, really good for what was expected of a wrestler. you know, the other Valentine, Greg. Just, yeah, Greg didn't look good at all. He didn't, you know, he just looked bad.
He looked like a frog.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think, and this kind of goes to, like, he was put in a position to succeed. Wasn't much of a talker, didn't have the look, but then you put him in a
He was a decent talker. I mean, he just never really got mic time, but when he got on the mic, he could cut a promo.
Yeah, short time. But you put him in with, like, pairing him with Brutus Beefcake was a really good pairing. And then having Jimmy Hart be the mouthpiece, like, all that worked for him. And I think it was a good example of taking a guy and letting him work to his strengths, where he's just this tough guy in the ring with this nasty finisher. And then you got, like, his partner is the flamboyant guy who, at the time, you know, Beefcake could get it done, too.
Oh, yeah. Beefcake was probably the second biggest face during that time behind Hulk Hogan.
Yeah. Well, he was even a heel. He was a heel and he was over. And it wasn't many guys... There wasn't many heels that were over big time with the crowd back in those days, and he was. But, like, Valentine was kind of the backbone of that team, and he was kind of like a small... He was like another kind of like Arn Anderson, like, not that big, but like an enforcer guy. Like, they really built up the idea that Valentine was as tough as anybody in that promotion, and he played it well in the ring. So, yeah, no, I love the Hammer.
It's kind of funny. We're talking about jobbers, you know, about how they know how to work in the ring. I think Valentine, if you kind of look at it, and without trying to be all hyperbole aside, I think Valentine's one of the last wrestlers where his ring work really vaulted him to a higher spot than what he should have been. Mm-hmm. He's like one of the last, like, old-time wrestlers where ability or ring knowledge really pushed him up to a higher level, and you don't have that anymore. And this guy could still, he was like a good, he was probably about a high mid-card guy. I mean, he was never the main event, but he was a backbone. You, like you said, with the Dream Team, he was the backbone, and it really kind of showed. Like, yeah, Brutus was the one that got all the accolades, and he was the guy that everybody saw. But Brutus couldn't hold a candle to what Valentine can do in the ring in terms of experience, in terms of him being a technician. It's funny that Brutus, the Barber Beefcake, took off. And then Valentine kind of went off on the side. But to me, he's like one of the last few guys where an old school guy went through the old school system of wrestling, tough as nails. You know, like if he got in a fight, you know, if, like, say, like, me and you were like to fight, and we would even try to, like, step up to Greg, he would, like, take us out in, like, 1 second.
Oh, yeah.
This is just an old school tough guy without trying to be tough, or it doesn't have to show they had to be tough. Yeah. Just a backbone of the guy, and I don't think I ever wanted to see a Greg the Hammer Valentine run. I probably would have never liked it, but in terms of respect level, all the way.
Yeah, and watching the matches that he's in, I would always want to watch the matches that he's in.
Yeah, because it was good. It was a good story in the ring.
Good psychology.
And if he won, you didn't get mad. I mean, if you won, you probably did get mad, but you respected the win. If he lost, you're happy that he lost. And that's really what a heel should probably do.
Yeah. And I think one of the better uses of some kind of gimmick interference thing, right? Like, you know, like with Honky Tonk Man and his guitar, is like, okay, it's pretty obvious he hit a guitar even if the referee turned around, right? You know, there's pieces of wood all over the place and stuff, right? Or like,
I dropped it.
Right, yeah. Like, or whatever kind of, like, you know, probably the shin guard and Regal's brass knuckles. Were probably, and Tully's roll of coins were probably three of the better, like, interference gimmicks.
But out of those three interference gimmicks, Valentine's was legitimate because he got a doctor's note saying exactly. That he needed to wear the shin guard because he hurt himself in an old accident way back when.
Yeah, almost as good as the Lex Luger plate in the elbow for the clothesline. Well, way better than Lex Luger's.
Oh! Boom! All right, so... yeah, no, good Hall of Kayfabe induction. I wish we could say more about this guy, but, you know, there's not that much you can say about him because what you saw with Greg the Hammer Valentine, you saw. But, you know, it's kind of like when we're at WonderCon, right, and we see him, like, at least for me, like, I saw him, and I would, like, steal looks at him. Like, I didn't want him to know that I was looking at him, you know, because I had such a respect for the guy. That I didn't want to, like, gawk at him, like, oh, you know, this and this. Like, you kind of gave him a certain amount of respect. Mm-hmm. And it was just kind of sad because, like, you knew that you couldn't go up and talk to him because he just wanted money. You know, he wanted money for, he's like, you knew he kind of would have said, like, well, I'll talk to you if you're going to pay the $15 for my autograph or whatever. Yeah. You know, so it was kind of sad that we weren't able to talk to him. It's really sad that that Erin Gray was talking the ear off of anybody that would talk to her, and you're too afraid. You know, you're hiding behind my – you're hiding by my coattails once again.
I just had all these visions of Silver Spoons and Buck Rogers in the 25th century.
That one where they ripped off her midriff, right? There's some like animals that ripped off her midriff and stuff. That was like porn back then, Dean. And you even remember that one. So let's go into this segment real fast. If there's a match that you remember, I don't have one. So
it's fresh in my mind because I just watched it the other day. We were messing around with the PlayStation 3 and found a YouTube app. And so I'm trying to show Xavier some of this different matches from different guys, Japanese wrestlers and whatnot. And I found the Samoa Joe and Misawa match. And so that...
Rest in peace, man.
It was a really, really good match. You know, we don't get to talk about too much TNA in here. I kind of wish we could, only for the fact that, you know, I'm a big Samoa Joe fan. And so, like, the match with him and Misawa was really good. Both of them... like, they got a lot, you know, they got their technical stuff, their high spots, their suplexes, their submission holds. They got everything in about 23 minutes. So it was just good to see the back and forth. And Samoa Joe pretty much, like, set the pace of the match. He hammered him for most of the match. It's a thing, I don't know if we talked about it on here, but it's this funny thing that I always have with the Japanese wrestling, though, is, like, they have tons of drivers and suplexes, but no one ever gets a pin off one. It's always off a strike. And so Joe, like, basically, what does he do? Like, Joe hit him with the muscle buster. I never seen anyone kick out of a muscle buster, but he hit him with the muscle buster. Misawa kicks out. Misawa gets him with the
elbows, right?
Emerald Fusion. Okay. Bunch of elbows. Yeah. Elbows all over the place.
Yeah.
And he hits an Emerald Fusion, and then he kicks out. And then he goes mid-rope Emerald Fusion, and Joe kicks out. And then while Joe's trying to get up, he runs and just vicious elbow to the back of the head, and then he gets the pin. I'm like, wait, that Emerald Fusion couldn't get the job
what's
done.
What's going on, man?
But it's a trip, because, like, you know, for that time, like, you look at Misawa, and it's like, he's not that tall.
Yeah.
He's not super built. He's kind of a little bit overweight.
A little pudgy and stuff.
But the dude was still athletic as fuck, man.
The thing about Misawa, right? So when you two first came out, it was like gold for any wrestling fan, because you could get all your wrestlers and watch all these wrestling matches. So who do you think was the one wrestler when you two came out? Who do you think was the one wrestler that I searched for and tried to watch matches of?
Well, I would assume it was going to be Muda.
It was Muda, exactly. So
you saw a bunch of Muda Misawa matches?
Yeah, and so, but here's the whole thing. So I was like, so, yeah, like the top, I think, who was it, the Dragon, what's the guy's name? The guy that does a really good top 10 moves of these wrestlers and stuff. The Suicidal Dragon. So, where's the Suicidal Dragon? Really has a sense of knowledge of wrestling within itself. All levels, any wrestler, you know, he's very good at doing it. And, you know, there's a lot of people that kind of, you know, try to get on the YouTube and comment and kind of like bash him and stuff. He's like, hey, man, he's like, listen, I'm doing this for this reason, this blah, blah, blah. So, really, really learned a guy within wrestling lore. So, I'm watching all these like top 10 moves of Muda. And there's this one guy, I'm like, man, who the fuck is this pudgy motherfucker, dude? I'm like, who the fuck is this guy? Uh-huh. And I'm looking, and then I'm like, oh, shit, that's Misawa. And it's funny, like, Misawa was kind of like wasn't a jobber per se, but he wasn't Misawa that he was before he died. I mean, Misawa was one of the most respected wrestlers in the world. Like, when you say CM Punk's his best in the world, Misawa was probably one of the best Japanese wrestlers ever. And I just looked at this guy, I'm like, man, this guy sucks. And then I started looking at him, I was like, oh, shit, that's Misawa. And I started looking at Misawa's stuff, and I was like, and all the stuff that Misawa innovated, like, all those elbows, dude. Like, any wrestling fan that has a wrestling game, and you look at those elbows, the elbow combos.
The roaring elbow?
That's all Misawa, dude. And so...
Well, he had like, these, like, sentoms off the apron.
Yeah.
And he could jump over the top.
Even his drivers, like, not only did he have the Emerald Fusion, and he had, like, some really sick Emerald Fusions, like THQ Games never gave his Emerald Fusion justice. I mean, like, my Fire Pro Wrestling game, there's like two Misawa drivers there, and you're looking, it's like, man, those are crazy ass moves. But he also had another one. He had the Tiger drivers too.
Tiger, yeah.
And then not only that, but then he had the he had the back drivers too, like
dragon,
the back
dragon suplex. Or are you talking about a backdrop?
It was a backdrop, but they were. Do you know the old school one? Like it was off the THQ game where he puts a guy in the full Nelson, and then he slams the guy back. Yeah. So you had the Tigers, and then he had like three or four types of Tigers that were really good.
And then there's the one that says Tiger Suplex 85.
That one, and then there's another Tiger Driver too.
Yeah.
That's even better. Like it's on the Fire Pro game. And then there was a front Tiger Driver where he lands the guy on the neck.
Yeah.
And he's getting pinned on his neck.
He goes right in on the pin.
That's all Masala, dude. Yeah. So yeah. So I don't know how we started talking about Samoa Joe and all this stuff, but I haven't seen the match, but. Any time that you can get a legend like Misawa going against a guy that should be a legend in Samoa Joe, I know it's going to be a great match.
And then the other thing I really like is, like, Joe always talks about that match as being, like, the match of his career and stuff like that. Like, the respect level that he has for Misawa and just, like, how happy he was that he got to participate in that match, you know. Misawa, you know, he passed away early, which sucks. But, like, for Joe to, like, have gotten the opportunity to have that match and appreciate what it meant. You know, I that's one of the other reasons why I really respect Joe too. But yeah, if you get a chance, it's a really good match. And yeah, like you go through there and you can see some of those Kenta Kobashi Misawa matches. I want to find some Kawada and Misawa matches too, because like the more I read about Kawada, like that guy, he's right up there too. So
yeah. All right, so. So this is the take-home with a scale, number 52 before Survivor Series. We got the producer coming down. We're going to go over to your house. And the kid always makes me drive, dude. I don't get it. It's like, dude, like, I want to drink. You know, he's like, oh, you're driving. I was like, well, why don't you just meet up at Kevin's house then? Why are you going to drive to my house in San Jose? Drive all the way to Milpitas, and I got to drive you all the way back. He's like, no, you're driving, like, or whatever, dude. So,
yeah, that's when you said like he had a problem with it, I thought it was weird because like, why?
It's just the way he is.
Closer.
Hey, this guy for like 4 or 5 years would not get on the flipping freeway. You know, now like we both have the same job where we have to get on the freeway all the time. So I'm like, man, where'd you come from? You never would drive on the freeway. I'm like, hey, why don't you come on down? I'm not driving on the freeway. I'm like, what the hell's the matter with you, dude? So
just take the back roads.
Yeah, take the back roads. Yeah, yeah. So so we're gonna purchase Survivor Series. My older daughter's all geeked up for it too, so she's gonna make an appearance,
uh-huh.
And then we'll talk about it after that. So I better have my donuts over here. I'm Bad News Ramen. He's at 49 followers. Let's try to give him that 50. You kind of go.
I'm not up to 50 yet.
No,
am I
not
fluctuating?
Yet. No, so I'm at. We're in the same boat. So you're at 49 followers, and I'm having a real problem because I'm at 447 followers. So I need to get that 450. You know, I need to get the 450 splash. You know, so let's try to get you one more follower. I could probably get 3 more followers during Survivor Series if I really wanted to. So let's work towards that. So movie skill number 52. My boy always over here came through. Very good show today with this guy over here. Better have my donuts. I'm Bad News Ramen. And we'll see you after the show, after Raw. And Raw's going to be good because it's after the payoff show. And that leads up to the Royal Rumble, which might not.
They have Night of Champions in December.
I think, whatever.
Which is kind of a
throwaway. Yeah, but I mean,
but yeah.
But we will get Royal Rumble and we will get that. So I'm kind of geeking up for that too. I still want to have a Survivor Series where everything is... I need teams of 5 strive to stay alive every single match. That's all I want to see, dude. But they can't do it anymore. So
They should,
because it'd be good for business.
I agree. I think they should. For me, I think they should figure out a way that they turn the Daniel Bryan and CM Punk versus the Wyatts into a 5-on-5. I don't think it'd be too hard for them to do that.
It would, because it's the WWE today. And so it's very hard for him. So we're not going to get it. It's too bad. Better have my donuts over here on Bad News Ramen. New skill number 52. And like always, we're good to go running in.
I hear the train a-coming. It's rolling around a bend. And I ain't seen the sunshine since I don't know when. I'm stuck in Folsom Prison. And time keeps dragging on. But that train keeps a-rolling. On down to San Antone. When I was just a baby, my mama told me, son, always be a good boy, don't ever play with guns. But I shot a man in Reno just to watch him die. When I hear that whistle blowing, I hang my head and